Do you still believe that we are in a kind of continuous history in which the lessons of the past are what should be guiding us going forward? Is talk of crisis in itself a kind of nostalgia?
Critical theory in context.
That's my basic question from this panel and going forward in this whole discourse is, what time is it? Like, what world are we actually in? Are we in the process of continuing a classic 19th, 20th century conversation about crisis? Are we failing to register the extent of the explosion?
That was Adam Tooze speaking at the Crisis and Transformation Conference on June 4th and 5th, 2026 at the Pacht Grimm Auditorium in Berlin. The conference was organized by Izette Schumacher and Rahel Yagi of the Center for Social Critique. My name is Jacob Blumenfeld, and this is Critical Theory in Context, the podcast of the Center for Social Critique. In the studio today, I have Robin Selikates and Rahel Yagi, directors of the Center for Social Critique, and Konstantin, the sound engineer. And today we're going to talk about this conference. We're going to talk about what is the meaning of crisis today. At this conference, we had many, many speakers, from Dipesh Chakrabarty to Isabella Weber, Stefan Lesenick, Joseph Tainter, Philip Staub, and many, many more. And this conversation will revolve around some of the themes that appeared and debate lines. For instance, does the category of crisis still play the role it used to play in social theory? Right. I want to, before we get to this kind of topic and also the themes of the conference in terms of ecology, social struggles, and economy, I want to start with a question to Rahel and Robin. Rahel, you organized this conference along with Izette Schumacher. Can you just try to tell me what was the aim of organizing this conference? Why now?
I mean, in some way, the topic of this conference does not require justification. It has become something like a defining category of our present. It is like everyone talks about crisis all the time, ecological crisis, economic crisis, crisis of democracy, and also multi-crisis. So in some way, it is pretty clear that crisis needs to be, that those crises need to be addressed. On the other side, I mean, the conference was not just about those crises as such, but also about the concept of a crisis and crisis theory. And one of the underlying ideas of the conference was actually that not only are we in trouble in, I mean, a whole variety of crises, but also crisis theory might be in trouble. So one thing is, and this is why you organize a conference, you want to get to do some kind of conceptual work. You want to become clear about what is actually a crisis, what is a crisis as against a problem or a conflict or a catastrophe. So this kind of conceptual clarification is something we aimed at. But there was also another underlying thesis, and this is something that comes out of the work that Izette Schumacher has done on crisis, namely the suspicion that we might face a new kind of crisis. So a kind of crisis in which it is no longer self-evident that the crisis tends toward their overcoming their own resolution. I think one of the most interesting things about the conference was that this question, are we still living in times of crisis or are we already in a time of catastrophe or something that you cannot even name yet? That was one of the underlying worries, I think. And in order to understand why this is so important, or what kind of change in our theorizing, our thinking about social transformation, our thinking about progress, emancipation, history, this means, it might be worth to go back to the original, meaning of crisis or the idea, or the let's say, to the kind of optimism that even when we talk about crisis, there's still some kind of optimism inherent. I had a conversation with one of the participants, Jay Bernstein, where we somehow agreed that in some way, yes, so the times of crisis are the good old times. I mean, or the times of good old crisis, where you would still think that there are some contradictions that would eventually lead to a solution or even have the potential and the means for the solution somewhat internal to them. So, I mean, since crisis is something that I would say crisis is the kind of dysfunction that is imminent, that is not just something that happens to a social order, but is a result of imminent contradictions of the social order itself. And as dark as this sounds, if we constantly say, I mean, we are all in a constant state of crisis, there is still this kind of optimism that there might be a resolution, there might be that the crisis has a productive force.
Exactly.
And yeah. This is exactly what I think is at stake nowadays.
Yeah, I think the idea is that crises point to a contradiction at the heart of society that can lead, that can surface them, and then we can politically or democratically deal with them, transform the cause, whether that's inequality or a democratic deficit or a destruction of nature or a rearrangement of the family. There's something that can be done that the crisis allows us to actually make our lives better, society better. And in this conference, there were panels on ecology, on society, on history, on economy, on struggles. And throughout the discussions, there was some of this idea you mentioned, this nostalgic idea of crisis, this productive idea of crisis, Promethean one, right, in which certain struggles allow for the possibility of transformation. But there was another running thread exemplified by maybe this Adam Tooze quote we started with was, is history continuous or discontinuous? Is there a break? Is there a break with the kind of world we're living in today? He used AI to make this example. Other people used ecology or the economy. But is there something different about the quality of the crises we're living in that do not allow for this kind of management, but they reveal something deeper? And how do you deal with that crisis of – not just crisis of society, but the crisis of our crisis concept as well? Can catastrophes be turned into crises, right? Can transformation emerge? Now – Robin, you work on transformation, right? You work on social struggles. Can you just tell me also about this other side of the crisis conference, right? So what was the idea of transformation here in that conference?
So thanks, Jacob. I mean, the first point to make, I think, is that for critical theory, those were always the two sides of crisis, right? I mean, crisis is on the one hand characterized by dysfunctionality, by contradictions, by the antagonisms that are expressed in the concept of crisis, maybe also by the potentialities pointing to its resolution. Someone at the conference quoted Brecht saying, you know, our only hope is the crisis.
Joseph Vogel, yeah.
There is no Hegelian or Marxist work of the negative in our financial capitalism. And the famous words of Bertolt Brecht, our hope is the crisis. These words is now, or are now, the motto of a very past and bygone age.
Okay, the Vogel. But at the same time, I think it's really important to remember that there was really never the idea that this would just be an automatism, right? That somehow the crisis would resolve itself or by itself lead to its own resolution. This was always tied to social struggles, to attempts at transformation. Crises, as many pointed out, Marx himself, Scheler-Bin, Hibbe-Brahil, Habermas, many others, are crises both because of their objective dimension, but also because of the way in which they're intersubjectively experienced, in which they are made into crises, and thereby always also already they involve struggles and struggles about interpreting, articulating, transforming the situations that are experienced as critical. And so, you know, in its original meaning, crisis, this idea of a turning point, of a moment that has arrived in some objective, undeniable manner, but that also opens up the possibility and the necessity of intervening and not reacting to a crisis is also a reaction to a crisis. Ignoring the crisis is also a reaction to a crisis. And so the question is, or has always been, I think, how this experience of the crisis and the collective ways of reacting to it, trying to transform it or trying to sit it out, how they are either contributing to a productive unfolding of the crisis or they just make the crisis worse in a way, right? And I think that fundamental structure is has not gone away. I mean, it's always also a good question to ask, you know, who has the power to declare a crisis, who is experiencing a crisis that for others maybe is normality that they have lived with for a long time. What are the consequences of declaring a crisis? Often crises are sort of declared from above by, you know, elites or dominant classes because they open up ways to introduce fundamental changes that would otherwise not be acceptable. There's a kind of politics of state of exception from above, let's say. And the saying goes, never let a serious crisis go to waste, right? I mean, so it opens up spaces of possibility also in that sense, which means that there's always a political dimension. There's always a question of the transformation, of the struggles that are involved here. And I think for critical theory, that's a fundamental aspect of the crisis of today as well. I don't think it's, I mean, on the one hand, I do obviously think it's true that there is something qualitatively new in the crisis tendencies of our time, and that there is a convergence and mutual reinforcement and maybe an apocalyptic dimension to this convergence that is new, and that has especially to do with the ecological crisis and the fact that humanity has ended up in a situation in which it's not just, you know, what it has been before, forces they themselves unleashed but could potentially control, capitalism, war, maybe even nuclear war, mm-hmm. that threaten to destroy our own conditions of living, but it's forces that we have unleashed, as Chakrabarty and others have pointed out, that will unfold whatever we do over a quite long time, and that therefore pose the question of transformation in a different way. But the question of transformation poses itself however we think about this crisis, right? I mean, there is no stepping back from that existential or practical or collective political moment in which it is also in a way up to us what we make out of this crisis, how we understand it. And that can be more or less adequate as we see today. You know, it can be, as we discussed at length at the conference, regressive, reactionary, fascist forms of reacting to the crisis by either saying, well, it's not really a crisis, or we can sit it out, or we will just have to make sure that those other populations suffer the harm this crisis will unleash while we protect the interests of our own. That's the idea of Fortress Europe, Fortress USA, etc., that we've been talking about. And there's the task, I think, for emancipatory movements and for critical theorists to reject that and to think of other ways of responding to the crisis, for which there are also a lot of struggles and movements and attempts at transformation today. So I would always emphasize that moment. I would also be a bit skeptical about those grand declarations that, you know, we are also naive and what our little struggles, what we want from them is kind of doomed to be a failure. Well, you know, what's the alternative? I mean, you know, I'm very much... well, not optimistic, but I do find some small quantity of optimism or hope, maybe also in the fact that there is a growing, you know, movement of resisting the catastrophic impact of AI, of just not wanting these data centers that destroy cities, landscapes, neighborhoods, etc. And I think, you know, if we give up on these struggles in advance because we say, well, this is just too big to fight, then I'm not sure what the alternative really is. At least as critical theorists, I think we have to hold on to this, because otherwise, you know, what is there to still do apart from just becoming fatalistic?
And I also think it's not just a question of optimism or pessimism, but a question of, I mean, what is the alternative? If we conceive of ourselves as human beings who are like able to act, to decide, to do something, then we have no alternative than, I mean, at least to act as if we can still make a difference. And I do think that, I mean, one of the topics that have interested us in times of fascization and upcoming fascism is the regressive reaction to crisis, and the fact that there is not only a progressive reaction to crisis and transformative reaction to crisis in an emancipatory way, but always has been a regressive reaction to it. But there's a second level to it that again points to a foundational aspect of the crisis discussion, namely that regressive, it is not only a regressive reaction to crisis that we encounter, it is already the way in which the crises are framed, the way in which they are declared a crisis. Migration crisis would be the best example, probably, is already regressive. Namely, regressive or somehow a blocked experience with respect to the crises that are really important, that are underlying this so-called crisis, which then points to, I mean, an evergreen of crisis theory, namely, again, the subjective and the objective dimension, and the fact that as we very often say, crises are given and made at the same time. So they are somehow given. If you're confronting a crisis, something does not work anymore. Something has become dysfunctional. You somehow stumble across it. You cannot avoid it. But at the same time, it is constructed. It is interpreted as a crisis. All those moments that come together as a crisis have been, I mean, you have to put them together in order to identify a specific crisis. And this is where the politics comes in. And this is also where Orbán also already mentioned it. The critical theory idea that crises have to be turned into conflict at some point. So the objective dimension must be, it's not only the case that there must be a subjective experience accompanying the crisis. So to talk about objective crisis without anyone ever having suffered from this crisis does not make any sense. On the other side, you cannot just subjectively make up a crisis, declare crisis, not without consequences at least. To hold on to the idea of crisis also brings in the idea that crisis can be latent. So there can be an underlying crisis that can or cannot be articulated. And then for us critical theorists, the interesting question is how we can help in this process of articulation, which then means to turn the crisis into a conflict. Whereas when you only start with conflict, then, I mean, conflicts are always, they are in the present. I mean, they are, they have a different like time span. So this is why I think for critical theories, it has always been, and also for Marx. I mean, Marx's theory of revolution is about the interaction between crisis and conflict, class struggle and crisis.
I want to focus in exactly on this problem that you both mentioned, on the critical theory of crisis and the role of the theorist in naming crises, articulating them, expressing them, and whether or not this act, I mean, not just critical theorists, but also those that undergo crises, this act of describing them is not purely an empirical phenomenon, but it's also a normative phenomenon. It transforms the object, it transforms what the crisis is, and it transforms the people in the process of theorizing it. I think this was kind of a fault line in the conference. For some of the guests here, I'm just going to name like Adam Tooze and Philip Staab and some others maybe, they had a more descriptive approach, I would say.
Sociology, however, would be sort of engaged in the business of empirically looking at what the results of that or what the consequences of that are. I could redraw to the position of saying that's just not the game of sociology. Might be the game of philosophy, okay, division of labor. I'm not a doctor and I'm not prescribing adaptation. That is not what I do.
So their account was that we can name these crises, we can describe what's happening, but this doesn't really have an effect anymore. I mean, even Silke van Dijk also kind of mentioned this, where the naming of the crisis no longer has a mobilizing effect on people anymore. It's consequentless, she says, right? It's demobilizing.
We actually witness the simultaneity of crisis awareness, especially among critical circles, and demobilization. And I think if we really want to talk about multiple crises and social transformation, we do have to understand this demobilization. And I think because there's so much longing for hope, this is always a little bit avoided.
Adam Tooze talked about how crises can't even catch up, or the naming of crises can't even, the democratic process of coming to terms with crises cannot catch up to the economic timescales anymore.
The timeline of American capital accumulation is now shorter than the cycle of American democracy.
Or Philip Staab arguing that the transformative aspect has been exhausted. And people are retreating to just survival and presentism.
The dominant cultural leitmotif, so to speak, of late modern societies shifted from one of self-realization to one of self-preservation. This is what our cultures are about now. Their imaginaries are now locked and are packed with what they conceive of as matters of survival and basic reproduction rather than progress, freedom, emancipation, etc. Everything becomes stranded in the present.
And on the other side of this fault line, I'm calling it, was this attempt to say no. There is no pure description of a crisis. The naming of the crisis and the theorizing, it always points to something beyond it.
I would say, I mean, there was this disagreement between me and Philipp Stubb. And in some sense, the disagreement is not about like optimism, pessimism, whether I'm more or less pessimistic than he is or optimistic than he is. It is also the underlying conflict here is a methodological one. Namely, exactly that he says, I'm just looking at the world and I see what people outside of this room are doing. And what they are doing is they are no longer interested in emancipation, but in survival. My problem here is not that those observations are somehow wrong, but that they are already normative in some way, or that the way you conceive of what people experience or the way they talk about their experience has to take into account a normative dimension and also a conceptual dimension. Namely, is it even possible? I mean, this presentism, is this even possible? If human beings are beings who are in some way always directed towards the future, what happens if they are not? Then, as I would say, it's not just an absence of a relation to the future, but a damaged or denied relation to it. And this damaged and denied relation to the future has some consequences. I mean, has regressive consequences, for example. You name it. Like you could even say that long-termism is a movement and an idea that is somehow a delusionary reaction to the fact that the future seems somehow blocked. So the disagreement here is also on the methodological level that I think it is and must be possible, and certainly for critical theorists, to have a critical analysis of those so-called empirical facts here, critical or to look at what kind of normatively loaded concepts already go into the self-description of people when they say, you know, I only care for survival anymore, or the practices that that lead you to think that they're only caring about survival, no longer about emancipation. I would say you will not even survive. I mean, you will not survive. You do not survive naked, and you do not even survive if you're no longer concerned about a better future.
No, I think I agree with that. I mean, the focus on adaptation or just the reproduction of what we have, I think we have, so giving up on transformation is both, I mean, it's a mistake on several levels, both for principled reasons and I think for strategic political reasons as well. Plus, there's the methodological problem that Rahil just talked about. I mean, adaptation can, of course, be a kind of short-term tactic when you confront the kind of, you know, violence or destructiveness of the condition that you find yourself in. But when you look at the broader forces that are not just sort of driving the crisis, but making it worse today. You know, the border regime, forms of capitalist extraction, exploitation, domination, the fascist project, etc. If you take this into account, there is no, I mean, to what are people supposed to adapt? The other side has already made a choice that sort of, you know, sacrificing large parts of humanity, destroying the conditions of living on the planet, that this is acceptable. You cannot adapt to that. Right? I mean, so this is both, I think, for theoretical reasons, something we have to insist on. That's the whole legacy of critical theory, that this destructiveness is not even a response to the crisis, but just makes the crisis dynamics worse and will have catastrophic effects, not just for those it designates as sacrificable, not having a right to be a part of the community, etc., but also for those who think that this is their ticket to survival, right? Plus, I think, so strategically, and that's something that, you know, others at the conference, Isabella Weber, Markus Wissen, Rodrigo Cordero, David Chabatachai, and others have insisted that, I mean, so, and that's something that people on the other side also know, right? And that's why what informs increasingly, I think, struggles for transformation that have become more systemic, let's say, over the last years, and that converge to a certain extent in the diagnosis that these are systemic crisis tendencies, and therefore the solution, or not solution, but response to them has to be systemic transformation, right? I mean, anti-capitalist struggles, obviously, but also migrant struggles, anti-racist struggles, the ecological struggles have increasingly moved to this recognition that there is something that binds all these different crisis tendencies together, that adaptation or, you know, short-term prepping, etc., that these are not really solutions, but maybe tactical adaptations for the moment, but that you need to hold on to this broader transformative vision to a radical transformation of social relations, institutions, structures of living together that, you know, respond to the crisis at the right scale, right? And again, I think, I mean, for large parts of humanity, there's no alternative to that, right? And so I think it's also realistic to say you cannot just be a realist in the sense of saying, well, there's nothing we can do about this, we just have to adapt. The only realism is to say we have to insist on a radical transformation of this, even though there is no blueprint for this, even though I agree you can't just rehash the old recipes from the past, which I don't think anyone has really suggested at the conference, right? So I think, I would think there's a realism in that emancipatory project as well.
I agree. I think that holding on to the status quo at this point, this is also something that came up at the conference very often, is not just, I mean, it's not just a question of what we want more and we have like revolutionary hopes that go beyond just preserving the status quo. There will be no status quo to hold on. I mean, the transformation is already going on from the other side, or from a whole variety of sides here. So there's no way to get out of the fact that you have to, this is change within change. This is transformation within major and huge transformation that is going on anyway, and that where there might be emancipatory and not so emancipatory solutions. I think that this has also played a role in the first panel when we talked about, with Isabella Weber, about anti-fascist economy.
Anti-fascist economics has to be an economics that is centered on livelihoods, that is centered on the essentials, and that where neoliberalism says democracy is the greatest thing on earth, but sorry, when it comes to your basic needs and to the essentials, there's unfortunately nothing that we can do for you. We can't step in. And anti-fascist economics has to say it's the first obligation, the first duty of a democracy to protect the basic material needs of its constituencies.
I do think that an interesting point here is again that anti-fascist economy cannot do without an emancipatory vision, because just to provide more resources will not solve the fascist crisis. Mm. It has to be connected to the idea of self-determination, of collective emancipation. I mean, this fascist slogan, get back control, not only make whatever great again, but also get back control, is something that has to be readdressed in an emancipatory way, I think.
It wasn't only Isabella Weber, but also Silke Aleksandrovich and others who brought up this idea of sewer socialism or infrastructural socialism or democratizing sectors of the economy, essential sectors, key sectors.
It is called sewer socialism, Abwasserkanalsozialismus. And I think there is a very important point, because back then it was the idea with sewage to address multiple crises of industrial societies, economic crisis, sanitary crisis, social crisis. And I think we do need sewer socialism, not many, many, many little tiny cooperatives, which will never, ever build Abwasserkanäle.
And the idea here was that, okay, there is this large-scale catastrophes going on in the world, these crises that are somehow beyond our imagination, that seem to be beyond our control. But what we can do, I mean, at least is what Isabella said, is we can take back control, right, in the sense, but over those sectors that should not be commodified, that should not be part of the market, right? Whether livelihood, basic goods, productive sectors, water, heat, energy, transportation, really nitty-gritty stuff, right? This is the idea. So no more grand ideas of revolution in the future or some kind of enthusiasm for an automatism of transformation, but to actually focus on those parts of the economy which life is at stake. And some of the speakers of the conference said, yes, this is what should be done, right? And maybe use the word even we, right? And others, I would say, like maybe Tuz or Philip again, would say, you know, wait a minute, who's the we here?
I wasn't talking about this room of us as sort of a marginalized left, right? And I was talking about what is happening out there the way I perceive it.
Who's the we that we're talking about here? And the scale is really way beyond these policies, right? We're on another planet. And Dipesh Chakrabarty is maybe in between here. You know, we are in a new world here. We're on a new temporality. But yet we also have to readjust our lives on a daily practical level.
As a student of history, it seems to me that all moments are heterotemporal because we're always in more than one moment.
So I also saw this as kind of a debate that happened throughout the conference, this more nitty-gritty, policy-oriented anti-fascist economics versus this coming to terms, riding the wave, almost accelerationist, riding the wave of crisis just to see where it goes. You could even tell this with Adam too sometimes. He gets so excited about these crises almost. It's all contingency. You know, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day. It could all collapse or it could go on forever. He showed this graph of the Dallas Fed, I don't know if you remember, in which the Dallas Federal Reserve said, you know, it's possible that AI could lead to greater productivity. It could lead to more jobs. It could also lead to the extinction of humanity.
As a possibility, we can't properly exclude from our calculations, and everyone should probably include it in their scenario planning. There is also the downward path to extinction, just mapped on the graph. There.
And this graph was meant to scare us, right? To frighten us and say, listen, this is what the ruling class is discussing, and they don't consider it a crisis. This is just part of their normal way of thinking. So how can we not scream, right? Shouldn't we be going crazy? And no one is, at least in his reading, no one is. So none of these things can really account for this.
I think he enjoyed scaring us, getting us scared.
I think so too.
And that is, yeah. And I do think that, I mean, you're right. I mean, there was this, those two lines, like infrastructure socialism, tiny, gritty, nitty, whatever kind of changes, socialization of goods and so on. And then the question of like the big radical transformation. But I do actually think that we did not actually buy into this old school, are you a revolutionary or a reformist? Are those revolutions, radical revolutions or reforms? I think that the idea of non-reformist reform here has a strong hold on it. I mean, practically all of us already, because we do not think that this is a meaningful alternative. As Isabella Weber said there, I mean, those transformations might scale up, might add up.
What I'm trying to push back against here is this idea that this is just a few Keynesian reforms. Of course we need much more than a little price control here or there. Of course. I mean, who has ever said that this is the final goal? This is the starting point, of course, but you have to start from somewhere.
And then you can doubt that, and you can, I mean, with all those ideas and measures, you always have to ask yourself, is this a reformist or non-reformist reform? Is it even, I mean, there might be reforms that even block further reforms or more radical reforms. And there are reforms that might just pave the way for wherever we are going there. So in some way, I think, yeah, it was present and it was, I mean, on this first panel, but it wasn't no longer present in terms of people arguing for a radical revolution as against those reforms, but people arguing for a major catastrophe to happen as against those reforms. And this is a shift.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so I like this idea of socialism to a certain extent, but I also also think it has its limits if it's positioned to in too stark a contrast with, let's say, the kind of more revolutionary transformative horizon, and also with the need for, you know, like encompassing theoretical analysis. Sometimes it has this ring to it, you know, the pragmatist who's not interested in these broader perspectives, but just says, well, let's just focus on the here and now and try to improve people's lives. And I think there's something to that. I think it's obvious that you need to offer a kind of leftist response to the experience of crisis and the experience that infrastructures have been destroyed, that people's livelihoods are in crisis, that you know, the infrastructures of social reproduction are under a lot of stress where they still exist. So in the fields of care, education, work, housing, public transport, living in cities, etc. I think there's an urgent need for such a program that you could, you know, group under infrastructural socialism or sewer socialism if you'd like. But it's also
socialization.
Yeah, and socialization, of course, as you know, you've been working on. But it's also obvious that this still requires a broader transformative understanding, because otherwise it wouldn't last, and it would, you know, I think there the skeptics are to a certain extent right. There it wouldn't last, and the limitations would ultimately undercut those local projects of sewer infrastructural socialism. And also you need to, because people have a sense that the crisis is more encompassing, right? You would have to answer, you would have to develop emancipatory leftist, democratic socialist answers to those broader encompassing crises, the climate crisis, the crisis of liberal democracy, etc. as well. So you can't just focus on the local, even if people have to start somewhere, and even if it's correct, I think, to say that people's basic needs are, you know, requiring a kind of everyday socialist, infrastructure socialist a response. But, you know, what are these needs? How can they be satisfied without sacrificing the needs of others that might not be in the same local context, but somewhere far away, you know, living the externalized costs of our mode of living that requires a certain level of comfort, etc. So these are questions, I think, that we can't avoid, again, for social theoretical, but also for political reasons, also because, you know, I think there is a real need to think about socialism as an internationalist or transnational project. And sewer socialism sometimes can limit or bracket these broader contexts, which I think would be a problem. So, yeah.
And I mean, sometimes you intensify a crisis by solving a crisis. By solving a crisis at one local level, you intensify a crisis somewhere else. I mean, this is what we call externalism here. And this has to be taken into account, of course, but it also can become much more complicated, much less of a zero-sum game. Which is why we need to study and analyze the connections between the multiple crises. So it's not enough to always say, yeah, multi-crisis, but it's the way they are connected.
That's the risk with the concept of polycrisis as well, right? It just says, well, these crises are somehow interconnected and they reinforce each other, but it doesn't really give you an analytics of how that is the case. And I think we need that, mm-hmm. right? And yeah. I mean, yeah.
I guess the idea with the polycrisis is that there's no single driver anymore. There's multiple drivers, and therefore there's no single solution anymore. So therefore, we just have to see how
they're all at the same level, right? Yeah. And it's as if they're just somehow randomly connected, and we can't really tell what drives what. I mean, it's true, there might not be one driver, and there might not be one cleavage, but certainly there's some factors that are a little more important than others, and that would need to be addressed urgently. Also, and I think capitalist accumulation is one of them, right? And you can't talk about AI as if this was not the project of financial capitalism, Silicon Valley, oligarchic elites. I mean, AI is a crisis for humanity, but it's not understandable without linking it back to the current state of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And that's also true for the ecological crisis. So the polycrisis can be a conceptual obstacle as well, I think, to understanding what is going on.
Yeah, can lead to like avoid analyzing those connections. And history does not have a single driver, and still, I mean, you have to address the effects of whatever drives, I mean, whatever multiple factors drive a crisis.
Mm-hmm. And some of those we can control, others we can't control, and we have to focus on those we can control.
Did you enjoy the conference?
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I was there the whole time in the front row taking notes. I had a great time. I mean, it gave me a lot to think about. I mean, I think one of the things I thought about most was this disconnect or this gap between local crises or crises that can be named, crises of a sector, crises of a field, and then this kind of what you were saying, this more generalized condition of the planet right now, this crisis, what Joseph Tainter said.
Something seems wrong.
Something is wrong. Something feels wrong. What is it? No one knows. I mean, I think the task for us is to have a theory of what that generalized wrong is. I would say something like generalized insecurity of the future, in a sense, a volatility of life, the inability to plan ahead, the inability to think of society as somehow existing today still, instead of just atomized individuals connected through technology without a future. So there seems to be generalized crises. I mean, Marcus Wisson talked about crisis of the planet, crisis of the mode of production, crisis of the capitalist formation.
Capitalist economies constantly produce socio-ecological chaos, which they externalize in space and time. That is what Uli Brandt and I have called the imperial mode of living.
Dipesh Chakrabarty talked about this planetary crisis as well. Stefan Lesnik even mentioned a crisis of the subject.
Talking of blockages of transformation in times of crises or polycrisis or multiple crises or Gesellschaftskrise or social crisis, we should take the subjective factor seriously.
Which I thought that was really good as well. Right? It's not just a crisis of the material conditions, but a crisis of how we are feeling and reacting to the world and our ability to cope. There was a discussion of overburdening, being exhausted all the time, the exhaustion, and it's the fact that so many crises make it impossible to even handle crises. Mm. So on the one hand, we can just describe this, you know, this is what's happening. But maybe we want to do more than just describing it and be like, okay, where are the contradictions, the antagonisms, the transformations that can cope better with this scale of crises? Does it mean turning towards infrastructure, socialization, or reformulating social bonds, reformulating our theories of how we connect to each other and the kind of future we want? I mean, this came up also in the ecocide discussion with Jay Bernstein and Maeve Cook and our relationship to the animal and the humans and animal connection.
The key point for present purposes is that human engagement with other than human agencies are sources, or at least potential sources, of educative, self-transformative ethical learning by humans. As Honig and Kimmerer put it, other than human agencies can give us instruction and teach us in ways that open new imaginings of new, better futures.
Holocene nature is no longer self-regulating. We have become a force of nature. It is increasingly unstable. It is undergoing constant rising temperatures. And because of the speed of climate change and the loss of biodiversity, the Holocene Earth system is becoming less and less resilient. The climate catastrophe is a slow, genocidal ecocide.
Dipesh Chakrabarty, I mean, I'm kind of going all over the conference here now, but when Dipesh talked about the complexity of these crises make it difficult for that which emerges to be reconnected to that which drives them, he said.
What drives something to the state of complexity or the state of the emergent property is something that we would call a driver. And the new emergent property is something that is a result of the driver driving this substance to the point of complexity, but the driver does not control the new emergent property. The new emergent property has its own rules. It is often a function of nonlinear processes, and there is often not a way that what is the driving agent can control the emergent property, the emergent substance.
The globe cannot be folded back into the planetary, or maybe vice versa. The planetary cannot be folded back into the globe. So this threat I really found interesting, right? The local crises and the general conditions of crises and the blockage between the two to transform what you said, Rahel, catastrophes into crises. I'm actually interested in what that meant for you, maybe for both of you. Yeah, what does it mean to turn catastrophes into crises?
To turn catastrophes into crises means to turn them into something that can be addressed by emancipatory movements, for example.
I mean,
catastrophe is just something that happens to you. And I mean, turning catastrophe into crisis, in order to do this, we need to analyze and spell out in which respect those catastrophes that seemingly just happen to us, come from the outside, interrupt everything, are self-made, are like the result of imminent tensions, contradictions, whatever. And there might be something, as Robin said, there might be elements that we cannot even possibly be in control of. But a lot of it, I also think that sometimes to talk about catastrophe instead of crisis has this defensive element, like, okay, if it's a catastrophe, then we cannot do anything about it. And then also it has nothing to do with our social order. It has nothing to do with capitalism. It has nothing to do with just happens. Mm-hmm. To turn a catastrophe into a crisis, first step is to see how this is man-made, is part of the social order, not just its other. And then the second step, of course, is to act on it and to try to figure out, maybe first turn catastrophes into crisis and then crisis into conflict.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, there is clearly widespread, fatalism, exhaustion, demobilization. That's true, but there are also a lot of movements and struggles, and there are those who insist that they cannot afford to be demobilized, right? And I mean, I had to think of this quote by Greta Thunberg, who said, we live in a crisis of crises, and the world has failed us, but we will not allow the world to look away. We will, in a way, force them, through activism and struggle to confront that crisis. Martin Luther King had a very similar idea of crisis, that you have to produce a crisis for those who have until now, ignored it, mm-hmm. and who have decided to turn away, or who just arranged their life in a way that they can live through it, exactly. And so I thought that was an interesting strand in the conference as well, where, again, some people just reminded us that people are also, fighting, mobilizing, trying to force the world to recognize a crisis that it misinterprets, displaces into racist, fascist projects of blaming minorities rather than, thinking about the structural causes of the crisis and ways to address it at the global scale. Gen Z protests were a topic in Debaditya Bhattacharya's talk.
I'm going to try and trace the social around the Gen Zs.
Rodrigo Cordero talked about reclaiming the future of breaking out of this exhaustion that the feeling of overwhelming crisis produces and declaring a will to another future.
In times of deep crisis, when a society can no longer imagine a future different from its critical present, where does it go to find one? So the struggle is to reclaim the future without turning it once again into an asset, a forecast, a calculation. A right to the future must mean the collective power to declare that some future must become real and that some imposed necessities should no longer govern us.
We talked a bit about the future and the way in which it seems as if those who just want to prolong the present into a future, so preserve the status quo without changing anything, that they have actually given up on the idea of a shared future, right? Because that project only works if you say, well, the future is there for us, we'll sacrifice others, because we have realized, the fascist project has in a way realized that if you just want to prolong the future that of the present that they live in, you can't do that at a global scale. And so Fortress Europe, Fortress US is that project. But on the other hand, there's an increasingly large part of humanity who knows and who will insist that a shared future requires thinking very differently about the future. It requires a different future. It cannot just be a prolongation of the past. So in other words, a radical transformation remains necessary precisely because we can't just continue, right? And then again, there's no model for that. You have to sort of start where you are and then see what fundamental transformation can come out of that in some kind of democratic experimentalism, probably involving planning, socialization, more or less local solutions that can then be scaled up. We've talked about migration as a kind of, Manuela Boyachief has talked about that, I've myself talked about this as a kind of connecting and tracking device that both traces the crisis dynamics that we try to ignore so often, especially in the global north, bringing the crisis to us in a way, insisting that there are these global connections already, but also maybe prefiguring or pointing towards more solidaristic solutions that do not compartmentalize, that do not try to suggest, which is, you know, doomed to fail, that we can somehow solve the crisis by abandoning others and just going at it ourselves.
If we learn from the migration or so-called refugee crisis, then what we can learn is that it was produced.
And so in a way, that's for me another lesson of this conference, that this is where we have to look. So yeah, be realistic, maybe sometimes even despair at the scale of the crisis, but at the same time insist that there has to be a solidaristic response to it, because only that will be the only future. Otherwise, there is no future, at least not a shared one.
Yeah, Isabella Weber called this neoliberal economics, she called it Darwinian fascist neoliberalism, this kind of everyone for themselves on a global planetary scale. And it's that which we need to fight, this kind of this lack of a future, this survivalism.
This is a Darwinian approach that literally chooses death for millions of people in the global south.
Jan-Philipp Kruse and Izet Schumacher called it the crisis societies that we live in. It's not just a crisis in society, but the societies themselves are turning into crisis societies, unable to deal with the problems that they've generated.
Crisis societies are marked by a deeply interconnected constellation of crises, economic, ecological, political, and social ones, which are tightly entangled in their causes and effects. You could speak of crisis society as spatially frozen formations.
Yeah, but then they also said that that's why we have to break out of, right?
Yeah,
because it's a downward spiral.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
That crisis, that inability to address the crisis, puts those societies on a self-destructive trajectory. And therefore, you both need a more adequate understanding of the crisis, but also a sense that the transformation has to be radical, because otherwise you will not. I mean, you know, the Benjaminian picture of the emergency brake did come up a couple of times in the course of the conference, because if there is the self-destructive spiral of crisis tendencies, crisis reinforcing responses and misresponses to the crises, then indeed the emergency brake is something that we need to pull, but that in itself doesn't yet provide you the alternative vision. So that needs to be developed in parallel to the braking.
Yeah. I mean, solving one crisis could accelerate another, like we said, right? Solving, you know, capitalism can solve maybe one crisis by displacing it or externalizing it. I just want to mention one more thing from the final panel on social struggles that you were at, Robin. Henrika Kopais, she discussed this openness to reality, right? The ability to have concepts that can be open to change, open to reality as well.
In order for the crisis to be addressed, critical theory must make space for transformation to occur and to be transformed itself.
Deva Bhattacharya talked about trying to think through what's happening in India right now with these Gen Z protests.
Who the Gen Z Indian subject is, and what is the historical concatenation of factors that leads to the Indian Gen Z subject?
You, Robin, talked about migration as a structurally anti-fascist kind of movement. And Rodrigo Cordero, talked about rethinking our relationship to nature and the world and the future itself.
What if glaciers, rivers, lakes could have rights? What if access to housing, health, education, and care could be constitutionalized? What if the law could open cracks in the walls of private wealth?
And I think this is also not just the task for us as political actors, but also as theorists, right? So how do we theorize these moments that are occurring in the present, this, how do we remain open to reality instead of blocking them out through our concepts, right? Through our crisis concepts that fail to be attentive and sensitive to these counter movements or these possibilities. I think that was how the conference ended for me. Can we remain open to reality?
That's also why we would talk about a blockage of experience, not just a blockage that concerns like action, but experience. Even the way we conceive of the world can be blocked.
And I like I think it was a quote from Alexander Kluge that Henrike brought to the conference as well, where she said, citing Kluge, well, you know, we should be realists, but being a realist has as a point not to just submit to reality as it exists, but to actually transform it, to contest it in ways that are effective. And yeah, that openness, I think, is fundamental to the task of critical theory and to emancipation.
Reality is real in that it really oppresses us. It is unreal in that every oppression only displaces energies. They disappear from sight, but they continue to work underground. The repressed is the source of all labor underneath the terror of the real. The motive for realism is never the confirmation of reality, but protest.
So yeah, that was the discussion about our Crisis and Transformation Conference organized at the Center for Social Critique. There'll be many more to come on The Second Decline of the West by Deepesh Chakrabarty, on fascization, on nature and ecology, and more. So we hope you keep paying attention and thinking with us. We appreciate you listening, and you know, we're always looking for non-evil billionaires to fund us. but just to end on a positive note, we could, you know, with Adam Tooze, we could posit this radical contingency and this break in history, that there's nothing we can do, just ride it, right? But that can lead to a kind of hopelessness, right? Nothing we can do, it's beyond us.
Fatalism.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, that's just what he even called it, like the subconscious of capitalism, right? The subconscious of neoliberalism is on display.
You know, the Darwinian subconscious of neoliberalism.
And it could, you know, even trying to understand it, to make it coherent, can be a bit seductive, right? To give it a logic, a power over us. I think we should rather follow Gillian Rose in Love's Work. She starts with this epigraph. And I forgot who said it, but it was some kind of monk. And he said, keep your mind in hell and despair not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Critical theory in context.